Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Kiss from a Rogue by Elisa Braden. Narrated by Mary Sarah. Prologue.
Be warned, sir. You have invoked an inexhaustible fire, quenched only by the defeat of its enemies. I await your surrender with the greatest of anticipation. Lady Dorothea Penworth to Malcolm Charles Bainbridge, Earl Bainbridge, in a letter of scathing rebuke. September 11, 1814, Wiltshire, England. She was floating here, in a bedchamber swathed in red, a room with a single window, two velvet chairs flanking a chess table, and low firelight flickering orange fingers across the dim walls. Hannah floated above the girl on the bed, pitiful creature, frozen as though stillness made a difference, never had before. Outside, rain poured, slithering grey on glass. Water's chatter upon stone and grass didn't muffle the sound. Clack, tap, clack, tap, clack, tap. Echoing across the terrace. Clack, tap, clack, tap, clack, tap. Down the steps. Clack, tap. A pause. She sank down toward the girl, every inch deepening dread. His voice sounded below the window, placid, pleased. Clack, tap, clack, tap, clack, tap. Receding, retreating, fainter, and gone. Blessedly gone. She floated again on the ceiling now. Grey light offered cooling comfort. Here you are, miss. The round woman with the Irish lilt waddled near the girl on the bed, placing a tray on the side table. She started to turn, then stopped, fingered the small bottle beside the teapot. Laudanum should help. Wrong. Laudanum only dulled the senses. Nothing helped. You should not have tried to take his horse, miss. He hurts you worst when you run. Heavens, you never learnt to ride. How far did you imagine you would get, The girl did not move so much as an eyelash. If I help you, he'll kill me. The woman's voice thinned until it had no substance, only breath. You matter, I don't. True enough, killing was his answer to many problems. Rebellious servants, inconvenient neighbours, her mother. In a vaguely maternal gesture, the woman brushed a black, damp curl from the girl's shoulder. The girl didn't flinch. But then she wasn't present. Hannah floated away, curled into the corner of the ceiling, where shadows gathered, grey and dark.
I should like to take that bloody walking stick of his and...
The woman's vicious utterance trailed away, unspoken. Her plump fingers formed a fist, before shoving into her apron's pocket. She plucked a green blanket from the foot of the bed and spread it gently over the girl's body.
There now, she whispered. Let old Mrs. Finney care for you.
Another brush of the girl's hair, wet from the rain.
Bide while, sweet miss. He has enemies. Dangerous folk. One day, they'll find him.
The woman's hand shook, a flush streaked her plump cheeks.
One day, he'll be gone. And you'll be free.
Hannah wished the woman would leave. Mrs. Finney was a fine housekeeper, but the girl on the bed did not wish to be touched, not by anyone, for any reason.
No more bravery,
the housekeeper admonished, while pouring tea and adding laudanum.
No more of this nonsense. Look at you, tiny, fragile thing. Mustn't continue inviting his punishments. And where would you go, anyhow? Should you manage an escape? Orphans haven't any family.
Mrs. Finney moved to the washstand and poured water into the basin.
Not that you could hide from him if you did.
She returned with a washcloth in hand, carefully unfasten the girl's damp gown and expose the girl's back. The woman's gasp rang out sharply in the silent room. In her corner of the ceiling, where it was dark and cool, Hannah let shadows cloister around her, muffling colour and sound and sensation. Time passed. She couldn't say how long. When the shadows thinned to wisps, Mrs. Finney was gone, and the rain had softened. Hannah watched the girl on the bed, huddled motionless beneath the green blanket. The girl's pale fingers lay curled near blank, open eyes. Slowly, slowly, as though tugged through a mirror, Hannah found herself pulled inside those eyes. Pale, pale green. No one else had eyes like hers. Only her beloved papa, who was gone. Gone, gone, gone. Now she stared through those eyes outward, saw the girl's fingers, her fingers, white and curled. They twitched. No, she didn't want to be here. She wanted the shadows, the ceiling. She wanted to float away again. Pain wouldn't let her. It sang with a horrid vibration. Mrs. Finney's words formed lyrics and accompaniment.
One day, he'll be gone.
The words chanted, repeated. A song more dangerous than enemies, more foolish than the bravery of a stupid, desperate girl.
One day, he'll be gone.
They crooned.
One day, he'll be gone, and you'll be free.
September 11, 1814. Lake Champlain, New York. Jonah should have been dead 10 times by now. 12, if one counted the enraged husband, who chased him with a cleaver, and the enraged father, who'd shot his hat clean off his head. But he never counted the incidents involving women in drink. Those were self-inflicted. The truth was that Jonas Bartholomew Hawthorne was not meant to die. Rather, he was cursed to watch what others did.
"What's that you're drawing there, Hawthorne? Your mother's titties?"
Rollicking laughter followed the jest, blending into the creak of the frigate's hull and the snap of her sails. Jonas glanced up from his sketchbook. The sun shone mirror bright off the massive lake this morning. While carpenters scraped and hammered, and ill-trained infantrymen heaved cannons into place, he was taking a few blessed moments before battle to record the scene around him. Miles of blue lake water, thick forested shoreline, a flock of geese flying overhead. Soon enough, death would come. For now, he would harness something beautiful.
"No,"
he answered Barry's taunt with a lazy half-grin.
"Your mother's titties are far more fetching. Care to have a look?"
His fellow soldier's mirth turned sour. At 20, Barry was only a year younger than Jonas. But he'd seen one measly skirmish on the continent before sailing to Canada with the 39th Regiment of Foot. Jonas had joined the 39th at 16. He'd survived muskets and cannon at Busaco, goring lances at Albuera. He'd watched men like Barry go blinding mad at Victoria and collapse like stringless marionettes at Toulouse. He'd watched countless Frenchmen die by his hand. Today he would watch Americans do the same. Jonas was ancient, and death knew him well. The ginger-haired Barry raised his ginger-whiskered chin.
"I don't let nobody insult me, ma'am, you blighter."
Chuckling, Jonas blew away charcoal dust from his sketch, tucked the small notebook into his pack, and squinted up at his appallingly young antagonist.
"Perhaps you shouldn't have let her cavort naked with the likes of me. What's cavort, Dally?"
Confusion turned to muddled wrath.
"You never even met me, ma'am. She's back in England." "No, indeed. Though nothing amplifies a man's pleasure like anticipation."
Confusion returned.
"What the devil are you saying?"
Jonas grasped the railing at his back and shoved to his feet. He moved slowly, as he'd always found being underestimated a valuable advantage. Likewise, he was tall, so he leaned back against the railing to reduce his height. Then he grinned.
"I'm saying it's best to avoid mentioning a man's mother altogether. That's what I said.
Then, we agree?
Barry scratched his gingered head.
I don't much like you, Hawthorne.
Jonas's grin widened.
Give it time, and you won't like me at all.
Another scratch, more frowning confusion.
When's the fighting start?
Jonas sighed and glanced behind him. They were passing the lighthouse on Cumberland Head. He expected the ships to begin firing before long, but dullards like Barry lacked patience. They itched for a fight, even if it was with their fellows. Jonas only wanted to be left in peace.
Not to worry, Barry. Soon enough, you'll be swabbing blood from the decks. Likely your own. If you survive, you can go back to swilling rum and insulting the mothers of colonials. A fine one to talk of swilling. I hear Lieutenant Phillips pulled your arse from jail to board the Confiance.
Jonas crossed his arms and chuckled.
A misunderstanding. Happens an ensign's wife is not to be believed when she claims her husband shan't return for hours. You was in your cups. Every man in the 39th would be in jail without the offence.
Barry narrowed his eyes.
You was caught kissing the lady in her husband's rooms.
Jonas smiled in remembrance.
Speaking of lovely bosoms.
Three more young infantrymen approached, flanking Barry and squinting at Jonas with varying degrees of nervous tension.
Last of the guns are in place,
said the blonde one, wiping sweat from his forehead with the back of a grimy hand.
Bloody hell, said the tall one with a wine-coloured mark over his cheek. Never thought I'd be pining for Spanish dirt again.
Clayton, Jonas recalled. The man's name was Clayton. He tried to avoid learning their names, but that birthmark was as vivid as Barry's ginger hair.
Aye,
said the wiry one, shifting from one foot to the other, as if struggling to hold his piss.
Lieutenant is speaking with Captain Downey. I expect we'll be firing soon.
Jonas turned his eyes aft. The smaller vessels of their squadron followed like lambs after a ewe. The Confiance was the biggest of them all, the biggest ship, the biggest target. Clouds momentarily covered the sun, colouring the water steel grey. He swiveled to look north beyond the prow. In the distance, a line of American warships waited to greet them with a booming welcome. He eyed the men before him, part of a hastily assembled crew for an unfinished vessel. He looked down at the pitch-stained planks beneath his boot. The decks were constructed of green wood, so rough the ship's massive guns initially had to be lifted into place rather than rolled. Even for a well-trained crew, which they were not, firing them was arduous. He glanced up at the rigging, sensed the brisk wind weakening inside the great white sails, felt a queer, foreboding chill.
I expect you're right,
he murmured, straightening away from the railing.
Best get to it.
He bent to retrieve his pack, just as a squat beaver of an officer approached. Avoiding the man's bitter glare, Jonas shrugged on his pack. Obviously, the ensign was still sore about the incident between Jonas and his wife's lovely bosom.
Take your positions, men,
the beaver barked.
Make ready.
They moved below to the gun deck. Another chill snaked through him at the chaos. Grizzled seamen bark commands at eight-man crews with too little experience. Even here, carpenters rushed about coated with shavings and weighed down by tools. 24-pound balls waited in racks to be loaded after the first volley. A hand shoved his shoulder from behind.
Move your worthless backside, Hawthorne,
the beaver snarled. He wanted to ask if the ensign's wife thought his backside was worthless. She'd seemed rather impressed, as he recalled. But he didn't fancy being stuffed into a cannon and shot across the bay. So instead, he held his tongue and joined Clayton and Barley and five other men at the 7th gun. An officer with a Scottish brogue, blue frock coat and wide epaulettes prowled the line of cannons, hands at his back, eyeing the crews. He was younger than Jonas would have expected for a squadron commander. 30s, he would guess. But Captain Downey's eyes looked as grim as Jonas felt. A third chill crawled up Jonas's neck.
Prepare to scale the guns,
Captain Downey announced over the cacophony. Firing the cannons would signal the British army in the village of Plattsburgh to advance in a coordinated attack.
Once we win the battle in the bay, our soldiers shall claim victory on land.
Jonas watched the captain, proud and straight, command respectful nods from the crew of inexperienced rabble and cast-offs from other ships. They all seemed to take reassurance. But to Jonas's eye, Downey did not look like a man about to win a battle. He looked like a man going to the gallows. Another creeping chill took hold, turning into an itch along his nape. Jonas's gaze drifted to Bailey, feverish with anticipation. Beside him, the steadier Clayton appeared confident, though his throat bobbed on a swallow. Upon the captain's signal, they scaled the guns. Each cannon recoiled several feet, stopped only by the ropes that secured the carriage. Jonas and the rest of the crew rushed to reload and heave the 2-ton gun back into position. His ears buzzed like insects. The ship kept its course toward the American's flagship, the Saratoga. It might have been seconds or hours before the Confiance suffered its first hit. Minutes, probably. When the blast struck, wood splintered and flew like bullets, the decks above shredded. Had his ears worked, he might have heard the screams of men dying. As it was, he couldn't hear much beyond the buzzing. He could see, though. One of the lieutenants, face streaked with blood, shouted at Downey, who stood beside one of the guns. Jonas saw the lieutenant's mouth repeatedly form the words, lost and sheet anchor. Despite his exertions, heaving upon the cannon's ropes, Jonas's chill now pulsed thick inside him. Bloody hell, if they lost the anchor, they'd little hope of manoeuvring into a proper position for battle, let alone turning the ship to avail themselves of fresh guns. He squinted through the gun port toward the Saratoga. The wind had died. Indeed, the Confiance seemed to have slowed to a crawl short of the position they needed for a full broadside. The Marine leading Jonas's crew gestured wildly, trying to convey the need to re-aim. Jonas seemed to be the only one who understood, so he shoved the frowning Clayton in the glassy-eyed Bailey toward the opposite side of the cannon's carriage. Showing them what was necessary, he rushed to the front and did likewise with 2 other men. The Marine gave him a nod of thanks. By the time the Confiance fired upon the Americans, she'd already taken fatal damage. Jonas had sensed it coming. The loss of the anchor, the dying of the wind, the ragged, inexperienced crew, even the greenwood of her decks. No one factor was responsible for the disaster that followed. Instead, individual drops of ill fortune coalesced to form a tide. One of the squadron's smaller vessels took damage early. It drifted like a child's toy boat between the Confiance and the Saratoga, denying them a clear shot. They waited and waited for signs that their land forces had advanced and engaged the American strongholds. Signs never came. Worst of all, no more than a half hour into the fight, Captain Downey was felled by one of his own bloody cannons. Hit directly by a ball fired from the Saratoga, the massive iron gun flew from its carriage and crushed the grim-eyed Scott beneath its weight. His watch was flattened too, marking the moment of his death. The gun crews, already exhausted and desperate, sank into despair. Jonas and the Marine continued shoving the other men into position, kept shouting though no one could hear, kept gesturing to reload. Jonas kept heaving the cannon bark into place, ignoring the slickness of pitch and blood on the deck, ignoring death's foul odour, the bitter tang of gunpowder burning in a flash, ignoring the listing of the ship as they took on water. Another blast tore through the Confiance's hull. Splinters of green wood flew, peppering his flesh like birdshot. He ignored it, forced his boots to grip raw planks, and yanked upon the cannon's carriage. Losing was no excuse for giving up. Another blast. Bright orange streak passed Jonas's peripheral vision. Wine-stained horror wreathed Clayton's sweating face as he gaped down at the deck behind Jonas. Gripping Clayton's arm, he shoved him around to face the opposite direction. No sense looking. Bally was dead. Probably better off. The wounded were being stashed in the decks below, where water was rising above their noses. Those who hadn't been blown to bits were about to drown.
Just load the gun, he thought. Load the gun and fire.
The crew to their left had been taken out in the last broadside. Half the crew to his right sat on blood-slick decking, their eyes vacant and downcast, heads lowered in defeat. Little wonder, the guns on this side of the ship were down to four. They'd lost a second anchor an hour past. Without anchors or wind, they hadn't a prayer of turning the ship for a fresh set of guns. Despite the hopelessness, despite everything, he grasped the ropes and forced his crew to heave the cannon forward into the gunport. On the lieutenant's signal, Clayton lit the gunlock. The shot shuddered the ship. Immediately, his crew rushed to reload. He clapped shoulders and offered nods of encouragement. He might not know their names. He might never see their faces again. But if they survived, he wanted them to be certain of one thing. The failure hadn't been theirs. Sweat stung his eyes. Smoke singed his lungs. His shoulders were afire from the strain of hauling a 2-ton gun into position over and over. Clayton's wine-stained cheek caught his eye a moment before he saw a flash from the Saratoga. But the boy's skin wasn't marked. It was white. White as the clouds above Lake Champlain. He turned as though to ask Jonas a question. Then his body went flying, colliding. A hard, wine-stained skull cracked into Jonas's jaw. Flashes of light swirled and sparked. 13 stone of fellow infantrymen flattened him like a weed beneath a plough. The force sent them both skidding across green wood in red blood. For a time, he floated inside white and grey. He heard humming. At first, he blamed the ringing in his ears, which hadn't stopped since the firing began. But no, this was musical. A soft, light voice. It wavered a bit, like lake water upon a pebbled shore. Timid, uncertain beauty. He wanted to capture it, to linger and bask. In the sound, the shy warmth. Land appeared before him. A rolling sprawl of pasture and sheep, barley and rye. Cottages, too. Thatched roofs in good repair. A larger house made of grey stone with, of all things, turrets on two corners. Like a castle in miniature. He sat in a garden, shaded by a draping willow taller than the house. Beneath his feet were square stones, and between the stones was thyme. The herb's fragrance filled his head, tasted like summer. Flowers spilled from urns nearby. A fountain splashed. He couldn't see it. For two sides of the garden were edged with high hedges. But he heard. Golden light slanted through the mist. It set everything aglow. Wind came up. Someday, it seemed to sigh. No, not someday. Now. He wanted to stay here, with her gentle voice washing him clean of death. He tried to insist, tried to speak. This is not how it ends, the wind breathed. Amidst white wisps in golden light, just beyond the willow's weeping branches, he saw black silk fluttering. A bird's wing, perhaps? A raven, shimmering black. She hummed her tune. Not how it ends, sighed the wind. Black slipped away between leaves, fog swallowed the garden. Her song grew faint, jittery, frightened. No, he wanted to stay. God, why couldn't he stay? Not how it ends. He needed to stay, needed to find this place, find her. White and grey faded into night. The buzz in his ears grew louder. A violent force shot him upward through a slit in the sky. Black became red. Gingery red, and wine, and wood. Something lay on his chest, heavy, couldn't breathe. Shoulders hurt, jaw ached, ears buzzed. his head rolled to the side. He allowed himself a single moment to close his eyes. Ignore the horror. Remember her song. Breathe. Then he shoved, rolled Clayton's lifeless body away. Sat up and looked at death. Everywhere. Everywhere. Ensign Beaver's big toothed face appeared in front of his, clean but for a bit of soot.
Hawthorne, the man mouthed. You alive?
Devil take it. Yes, he was. As always, he was alive and surrounded by death. It appeared to be his punishment, and a cruel one at that. Ensign Beaver mouthed something like, surrender. The gun deck was littered with the debris of war. Bodies, blood. Parts that should have been men and no longer were. The creaking, broken ship listed sharply. Jonas wanted to laugh. Absurdity usually did it. What a godforsaken farce to send men like Clayton and Barely, infantrymen posing as sailors, to fight in an unfinished ship, then surrender only after the slaughter. They died for nothing. No bloody thing. Yes, he wanted to laugh, but he was covered in their futile blood. And he could still hear her humming. Only a memory, of course. But it was sweet comfort. Someday he would escape this vile world. For now, he would find pieces of beauty to keep him sane. Green shoreline in blue lake water. Or a glimpse of shimmering black between willow branches. Someday he would have a place of beauty rather than war. He'd stand on stones that smelt of time, watch sunlight cut through mist, and know that he'd found home. A home no force in this world or the next could make him leave. Chapter 1. A tedious ride on a lame mount holds more allure than a dance with you, my lord. Perhaps it is the company. Lady Dorothea Penworth to Malcolm Charles Bainbridge, Earl Bainbridge, in a letter expressing dissatisfaction with said gentleman's conciliation. July 11, 1826, Primvale Castle, Dorsetshire. Sea-scented wind streaked past Hannah's cheek, while her mount's galloping rhythm pounded as fiercely as her heart. Coastal soil flew. Tall grass rippled like water. Sunlight warmed her velvet sleeves. Her rides were never easy. Even now, a year after she'd first climbed onto a saddle, her palm sweated where it gripped a riding cane. Rods of any sort tended to cloud her head. But, with help and time, she denied fear its victory. Or nearly so, at any rate. In the beginning, the best she'd been able to manage was a slow, rocking walk upon her gentle mare. And that only when her sister-in-law, Eugenia, was by her side, cajoling and challenging and insisting that she was strong. She wasn't, of course. Every moment had been filled with torturous dread. In time, she'd forced the queasy twist of her stomach to recede. She'd forced her grip to lighten on her horse's reins. She'd pushed herself, day by day, to trot, then canter, then gallop. Now, every day after breakfast, she rode Astrea across her brother's vast lands. This morning, the sun glimmered upon the sea as she raced along the high bluff above Primvale Cove. Her legs gripped the side saddle's pommels, as Eugenia had taught her. She bent low over Astrea's neck, driving her mount and herself harder. Speed was the thing. If she ran fast enough, it felt like flying. Soon Astrea's sides heaved upon harsh breaths. Hannah slowed their pace, guiding the horse inland, back toward Primvale Castle. "We've done well today," she murmured, stroking Astrea's neck. Her voice trembled only a little, scarcely noticeable, really. She sat straighter, inside. How she loved this place. Her brother possessed an extraordinary talent.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?